This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices. You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
We're leaving today and entering a world of Mickey Mouse waving, princess meeting and greeting,
lightsaber clashing, the Twilight Zone Tower of Terror dropping,
banshee flying, space mountain launching, galaxy rewinding,
what's the whole network galaxy rewinding,
fireworks igniting, world of other worlds, for whatever you love, infinite worlds await at the most magical place on Earth, Walt Disney World Resort.
Sierra has all the best active and outdoor brands you need, from athletic stuff, like a full-court pickup game, swish, to athletic-ish stuff, like a half-mile stroll. Get those steps in! And for morning hikes up the mountain trail, good pace, to nighttime ghost stories from the camping chair. What a twist! Whatever level of active, Sierra loves it all. Head to Sierra or Sierra.com for the brands you want at the prices that let you do it all. From athletic to athletic-ish, Sierra's got it.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm-fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
You saw the game-winning play once, but have to replay it 3 times on the way back to the hotel. Because some moments don't end at the buzzer. Life's a trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Book direct and save at bestwestern.com.
Welcome to the Huntivore Podcast, powered by Sportsman's Empire, where we celebrate the hunting and fishing lifestyle through the utilization and consumption of our wild game. No egos.
Fork in hand, beer in the other.
No status.
A piece of red meat on a hot grill and turn it into a burnt offering.
Just catch it, cut it, cook it.
This is episode 158, Half-Ass Off-Grid with Chris Bain. On this episode of Huntivore, Nick gets a hold of Chris Bain, a native of North Idaho. Chris is on a journey we all dream about, going off-grid, building our own creature comforts, getting our essentials in order, and living off the land. Chris can tell you it's a one-step-at-a-time process. Come along on a great discussion about self-sufficiency on this episode of Huntivore.
Well, hey, folks, beautiful afternoon. Yeah, beautiful afternoon here in Michigan. Summer is back right here at the tail end of it. I know, at least at the time of this recording, we are getting super close. We're in the middle of September. We're almost at the equinox. It still had one more, like, jolt of heat to us. We're sitting in the 80s. I think some rain is coming by next week. I think it's going to save us the weekend, but then rain is coming, and I think we're finally going to get another chill down. We got hot again, and then now hopefully we chill back down and we can actually start fall. I mean, shoot, we're only a couple weeks away here in Michigan. from the bow opener. I believe the Liberty Hunt, which is kind of encompasses the youth hunt, has already, it was this past weekend. Didn't see a whole lot of photos. I think there was a lot of people that were definitely like, shoot, how can I go out in 80 degrees to try to go shoot a whitetail? I don't think a lot of guys were going to do that. So anyway, that's neither here nor there. But folks, we are on it tonight. We're gonna come to you electronically, but at the same time, we're trying to pull off this grid. We're trying to pull ourselves away a little bit. I am joined by Chris Bain. He runs the channel, or at least the handle, Half-Assed Off Grid. Chris, thank you so much for joining us in here from Idaho. How are things in your neck of the woods?
Oh, it's beautiful here. It's about 72 degrees, bright sunshine, full moon, basically, you know, so everything's just running around all night and then running around midday to come home. I had to shoo the deer off the road to get home. They're just, you know, everybody's just out and about.
Yeah, gotcha. That's a great problem to have where you need to shoo the deer from getting up your driveway. That's something I would definitely want to have in my back pocket. So living over in Idaho, your idea is the whole process here. We're trying to get off grid. You're trying to make sure that you are being able to sustain your lifestyle by being disconnected from everything else, whether it be sewer, whether it be electric. That's your goal. What are you sitting at currently? Where are you currently at, and how is that journey going for you?
It's going pretty good. My wife and I, we're officially empty nesters now, and we both work 9 to 5, you know, just like everybody. Well, I'm 7 to 3:30, but we live in a very rural area. I work in a town of 10,000 people, and it's about a 15-minute commute from there to here. And so here I live in a neighborhood, I guess you could call it. There's a bunch of 10 acre parcels, some 20s mixed in. My neighbor across the street has 160. And so it's pretty sparsely populated. One of the more interesting things is trying to get into the social media side of it. We have sketchy internet at best. We have old copper phone lines that are like 16.6 out in front of our house. If you want to do anything, you're hotspotting off of a phone or satellite or Starlink or something. But we really enjoy the freedom of not being hooked to anything. I mean, we have a community water source. We do have electricity here. And my wife and I just really enjoy unplugging. And so a few years ago, we bought a piece of property even farther north, and we found 5 acres, and it borders about roughly 20,000 acres of national forest that's south of it. So like our property line is Forest Service on the back side. And the nearest power pole is 2 miles away. And there are neighbors there, but I mean, cell phone service, you can only text. I mean, you can't even make a call there. Every once in a while you can like get your voicemail to go through, but that's it. And so we really use that place just to unplug and, you know, get better at some of the old ways, you know, some of the traditional things. We enjoy foraging, hunting, fishing, just being outside and being away, you know. I mean, ideally, I want to retire there. And I don't know if my wife will. It's a little far from a hospital for her tastes. But, you know, it's definitely a refuge in the modern world.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Hi, Archie. Did you need to say something? Do I know where the tape is? I do not. I'm sorry. You'll have to go find some. Sorry about that. I had a quick little interruption.
Oh, no problem.
I'm excited. I'm so excited hearing just how you guys are getting your start there, getting the piece of property, getting away from everything, and now you're trying to utilize that. My wife and I, we've taken a couple trips up to the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. We may not be that sparse as what you're talking about there in Idaho, but we're getting in the ballpark. We're very similar there, and you do see people that you know, they get real excited about it. And I know my wife and I, we were pulled a camper all the way up there. And we saw all these for sale signs, all these parcels of like, oh, this would be a great little spot. Or, oh, we could have a little cabin. And I think as we went through that trip, we saw more and more and more of these for sale signs. And I think it was on the backs of all these hopes and dreams, because it's a trek getting from the lower peninsula where we're at to the upper peninsula to take care of that cabin. Mm-hmm. Every time you go up there, it's a work weekend. Even though you want to go enjoy it, you got to fix something with the plumbing. You got to fix something with the structure of it. You got to cut the grass. You got to chop the wood. There's just this endless chore list. And I think that is something that kind of gets negated when it comes to the idea of, hey, we want to go off grid, like this fairy tale, this very like romantic view of being off grid. But it's like, hey, folks, if you can do it, you can go off grid. But there is a lot that goes into that. What was your biggest learning curve when you and your wife decided, hey, we're empty nesters, we want to disconnect? What was that big hurdle that was like, ooh, this is something real?
Probably the biggest hurdle that we had is we bought the property when our youngest was still in high school. And, you know, it was like, we got a place, it's got an intermittent stream, you know, it's great, full of timber, the whole nine yards. Once we got into it, and we were just like everybody else that started out, you know, we were watching all the YouTube channels on who does what and how they do it. And there's some out there that are really good and really genuine. And there's some that I think they exaggerate and embellish quite a bit, because there, as you were saying, is a lot of work to it. We built the cabin by ourselves. It was me and my wife and our 16-year-old daughter at the time. And I mean, just the rafters, it's an A-frame, you know, just pulling the rafters up, they're 20 feet tall, and you had to stand them up and nail them off individually. And then, you know, we had to sheet this gargantuan A-frame. And I mean, the pitch on it is like a 9-2 pitch. It's technically considered not a roof, but a wall. And we did that, you know, for the snow load, but there's a lot of work that goes into it. And then, you know, that was part of the reason that we started our channel as well, is because everything we put on there is real. I mean, I know I don't get the views of some people, but everything we put on there is honest. And really, honestly, some of my early videos are really bad. Now they're just kind of bad.
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head too, is like, as you're going towards your goal, you're acknowledging that there's going to be a learning curve. You're acknowledging that there's going to be some hiccups. And I think that's where, you know, the half-ass part of it, like you said, we've covered, you know, a few bases. We still got a long ways to go, but shoot, like you said, you're a 9-to-5er. When it comes to hunting and fishing, I think I'm pretty half-assed too. Just because, again, life is going to come at you. I've got some grandioso ideas, but man, does it take a lot of work to realize those? You get the cabin built, and now you start living out of this cabin. I was looking on your Instagram here just a little bit, and it's, you were laying out a little bit of, you know, oh, now we've added a deck to the back of the cabin. And so you're starting to make this home. What are some of the steps you've made to make this lifestyle change, or to really like make lifestyle happen up there as far as acquiring water and getting food? How are you making this sustainable? What are some of the things that you're doing up there?
Well, one of the things that we do, in all honesty, I can't lie, my line of work, my area of expertise is actually infrastructure. That's what I do for a living. And, you know, to get up there and realize there's nothing there. I mean, you are building from the ground up. And, you know, one of the great examples is COVID hit, and we're like, all right, well, we got stimulus money. What are we going to do? Because, you know, nothing's open. So we bought a sawmill. And so all of the boards on the inside of the cabin were milled by us from pine that was on our home property, and we hauled it up there. Well, then you realize that when you're hauling this stuff up there, you know, it's an hour and a half drive, and probably 2 months out of the year, you can't drive up the road to it, you know, so you have to take this stuff up the driveway on a sled, you know, and so you start picking away at the things that they're, you know, at first you think they're creature comforts, but then you're like, no, this is really a thing. Our water, we still pack water in, basically. We bring it in barrels, and then we have, I don't know if you're into naming names, but we have a Julica on-demand hot water heater and shower combination, you know, because hygiene obviously is a thing. And then, you know, you need some power, some source of entertainment. And one of the more entertaining things to me is, you know, had one of those post-Christmas Amazon things, and we have a giant TV in there, but there's no TV reception. You know, we have a box of DVDs, right, and it runs off of a battery pack. You know, that's entertainment there. So, you know, just the realization that when you're there, I mean, like I said, there are neighbors that can help you that are, you know, very close. But when you're there, you're on your own. And, you know, I don't think a lot of people consider that. When we first got the property, I actually had an accident up there. It was pretty severe. And I ended up, you know, driving myself to a friend's house in another town that was a half hour away. And it was dark, you know, when I got burnt. I was in a propane explosion. And so I drove to his house. He's like, you got to go to the hospital. So we had to go an hour back down to the hospital, you know. So people don't consider when you're on your own, you're on your own. But luckily, we have a lot of rural experience living where we do. I mean, our power is out all the time here anyway. When power goes out, water goes out. You know, that's just, it's just how it is. You know, so there's a lot of familiarity. But then, you know, you realize, like I said, you're on your own. And I mean, the first year I hunted out of that cabin, we had it dried in and everything, but it was uninsulated. And the only thing that we had for heat at that time was a two burner wood cook stove that burned little teeny blocks of wood, like the size of a beer can. And let's just say it was cold.
Yeah. Hopefully the sleeping bag at least provided a little bit of warmth there on that one.
Oh, yeah. Nobody goodness. Wanted to get out of them.
I think. Yeah. Going back to just what you said there too about the accident, like that is something I think anybody that ventures, like, shoot, if you go on you go real deep into the woods, even here in Michigan, I would consider ourselves rural, but we're not to the extent of capital R. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, there are places here where you can get super deep. And even in those areas, if something were to go wrong, you have an accident like you were just describing. Shoot, except you know, twist an ankle, snap a tendon, you know, break a bone. That's a harrowing adventure there to get yourself out of that.
Mm-hmm.
And to be, you know, working with propane, to have that explosion happen and then be like, there is no one coming to save me. I can't get a hold of anybody. Nobody even knows. And so as a, you know, here with you are with these burns, having to drive a half hour, you know, that's for us, that's going to Grand Rapids. And I hate going to Grand Rapids. So yeah, it would take a severe burn for me to even head up to, you know, to someplace. So, mm-hmm. Oh my goodness. I mean, you're here now. So it's a tale you can talk about, but I think that's, again, yeah, we're getting out there. We're really reaching out there. It's not just a week hunt. You're looking to create a lifestyle out mm-hmm. there. You're looking to create, you know, time where you're spent for extended periods of time. Have you broke ground out there for gardening yet? Have you broke ground in there to start raising anything? Because it sounds like you're still in southern Idaho, or at least a little more south than the cabin. Have you started putting together some sort of pantry where you can keep stuff for you?
Just to clarify, we live in North Idaho. We live in, I mean, very far okay. North Idaho. My wife is just in southern Idaho on a business trip. So that's why I was using it to test.
Gotcha.
But cabin is about an hour and a half north of here. And we just put in a little herb garden because we get into a lot of you know, foraging and things like that. I mean, I want to be a better forager, and I was, you know, kind of came to the game late. I mean, my family has always been very rural and, you know, very hunty, if you will, but other than a few varieties of mushrooms and stuff, nobody, you know, really did anything. So we did put a little spot in, and, you know, we're trying to get stuff to grow, but the property we have is so heavily timbered, and it's actually a northern aspect, you know, so it faces north. And so I don't know what we're going to get to grow there. So far, we've got onions and blackberries and some spices. And then as far as...
There you go.
Yeah.
A lot of accoutrements to whatever else you make.
Right. And then we don't have a ton of stuff up there. We were thinking about putting a root cellar in. We haven't gotten that far yet. But we have, I mean, you could easily go there, my wife and I could, and, you know, eat out of the pantry, if you will, that we have there for a week easily. And, you know, it has a lot of home canned foods and, you know, some regular canned food, dehydrated stuff, things like that, freeze-dried meals. Like I said, you know, being the infrastructure is like my job, I'm very aware of emergency preparedness anyway, because, you know, I work on the grid and I know just how fragile it is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That might be a topic that, as we're going along here, folks, we have a guy who works on the grid, who's trying to get away from the grid. If that's not any sort of warning sign to anybody, then maybe we should have a little bit of wherewithal.
Yeah, that'll definitely be coming up on our channel soon.
As you're working in that infrastructure, as you work with our aging infrastructure, what are really some of those like points where it's like, man, this, if one little thing goes wrong, we're done with? I think we're seeing a little bit more of that. Shoot, the Baltimore Bridge that just happened, I want to say earlier this year. I think that's an example right there of just, you put a bridge up and it's got a lifespan. It's not going to stay there forever. And yet we blindly drive over these day in and day out. I think we've heard a little bit about the electricity. I think they took off, don't quote me on all this, but I think they took off two of the nuclear plants that are here in Michigan. They went offline, and I think there was a real push to get wind. A lot of windmills up north, trying to get those to take off. And now those nuclear plants are getting reopened. So I think experiment wind didn't go, I think, the way they were wanting it to. What are some of the real fragile things that you're seeing in Idaho?
Well, basically, my main area of expertise in infrastructure is water, wastewater, and transportation. That's what I do for a living. And a lot of people don't realize if the power goes out, yeah, we have backup generators. Everybody does. But about 72 hours is what you get out of that. So if the power is out for 72 hours, you know, there goes your water. And hopefully, you know, people can conserve the best they can. But once the water's out, then your sanitation is gone. And, you know, what are you going to do then? You know, because if the power is out there again, you know, you've lost your ability to pump gas at the local gas station. You know, so it's not like bugging out is a reality, you know, right off the get-go. But people don't realize that it's a finite period of time that you're dealing with. And, I mean, there's a reason that FEMA and Department of Homeland Security tell you to prepare. I mean, I've been to numerous trainings, and, you know, it's very explicit that, you know, when something happens, like the city that I work for, if something happened that was region-wide, like, you know, somebody breaches one of the dams out here, or one of the, you know, a section of the substation goes out, you know, your 72 hours is up. Well, the bigger town in the area is, you know, has more people to serve. So when they bring their forces to bear, when, you know, emergency operations comes in, they try and get as many people as fast as they can taken care of. Well, the people that are, you know, in small towns or rural, they're on their own. I mean, it's that simple, and it can happen that quickly.
Wow. Not only, yeah. Man, to say like 72 hours is the ticking, the clock that you're fighting against, but at the same time, you're also going to be at the end of the line as far as help coming, because it's going to go to those major metropolitan areas or even just the bigger town. Mm-hmm. That's where they're going to head. Oh my goodness. Well, good. I got my boy a 22 because we're looking for small games. So maybe that's going to be part of our emergency plan, is if all else fails, we can shoot squirrels. We're getting closer to doing that.
Oh, good idea.
When you're up in the cabin, when you're at home, what are some of the major species that you go after? I mean, you know, everybody's got their favorite big game. Right now, if anybody's looking behind you, if they're watching on YouTube, you know, you got a beautiful looking whitetail behind you. Thanks. And just a majestic moose. How easy is it to get a moose tag in Idaho for you as a resident?
As a resident, we've kind of had some issues because we have wolf issues in North Idaho. And so the tags have been getting harder and harder to come by because they've been dropping the numbers. I got my moose in 2015, and I actually shot it as the crow flies about a mile from my house here. And, you know, it's just because there's a bunch of timber, a bunch of timber company right behind where, sorry, I got to fly, a bunch of timber company right behind, you know, where I live. And, you know, the moose were just thick. And I saw a moose that was similar to this one a couple of years before I started putting in. So I put in for 4 years before I got the tag, and there's no preference points or anything like that currently in Idaho. So I just had to wait. And then I drew the tag and I knew where he was. I knew what he did and all that. And then the timber company closed down the property that I hunt on back there for fire, you know, because of fire danger, and opened it up 2 days before the season opened. But we have moose here. We have moose, whitetails. We have turkeys, and they're kind of a nuisance here. They were released, like, when I was in high school, there was no turkeys here. Now there's a lot of turkeys. You can get 5 turkey tags. And before the before they started offering the 5 tags, I mean, they would come down my driveway here and just, like, decimate the yard. I mean, there would be a couple hundred that would, you know, come through. And they've been whittled down to manageable levels. I mean, you know, they're kind of like yard deer. You don't really shoot them unless you have to. But pretty much everything you can imagine we have here.
Good deal. Yeah, I know we were corresponding a little bit back and forth, and you got a hold of my turkey episode. Mm-hmm. It's here in Michigan, their numbers are coming up. They're still introducing them. They're stable, but it's really like they're being very, conservative with how much you can take. Mm-hmm. I want to say last time I checked, it was 2 turkeys that you could take here in Michigan. So to hear that you could take 5 in Idaho is super neat. Has that been, I mean, again, as you're whittling them down, I mean, shoot, when it comes to, you know, 5 turkeys, each one of those, you know, possible toms could be, you know, 20, 22 pounds, even upwards of that. That's a good haul of meat. Mm-hmm. Has that really been a big beneficial, like it's just an easy access when it comes to putting more meat in the freezer?
It definitely is. You know, the animals here aren't quite as big as you would think, you know, like, from what I understand, deer in Michigan are very large compared to ours. I mean, a 100-pound deer hanging and trimmed is, you know, a very adequate deer here. But the turkeys just don't grow that big. I mean, a good tom, you know, 7-8-inch beard, he'd probably be 15, 16 pounds, you know, and the hens are 10, 12. God, this fly is driving me nuts. Sorry. But, yeah, you get 5 of them, and it's, you definitely start experimenting, you know, because, you know, everybody has their turkey leg horror stories. And I know there's a lot of people that just breast them out, which, you know, that's their choice, but I prefer not to, because there's a lot of meat on those hindquarters. And so that's how we got into making sausage out of them. And, you know, you just bone them out and, you know, right down to the drumsticks, and you can make 30 pounds of sausage and nothing flat. But, you know, we make Italian sausage.
Oh, yeah.
Anna Dewey. There's a local one. it actually, I guess, originated in the town that I work in. And it's just an onion pepper sausage. And you can get it from Miklich Spice in Spokane, Washington. They actually recreated the old guy's recipe and sell it now. But, you know, turkeys are just, they are fantastic sausage because they still taste like turkey. You know, I mix it with 50-50 pork trim that I get from one of the local butchers. And the meat will bind that turkey meat up. And, you know, the fat melts at a pretty low temperature. So it just is the perfect combination, I think, for the turkey sausage.
Yeah, yeah. I like to do at least half and half when it comes to, I even use the white meat. Mm-hmm. This is how we do it at the turkey farm. And then subsequently, if I end up with a buddy who shoots a tom, he's like, hey, I just want the fan. Can I have the fan? You can have the bird. Like, heck yeah, man, I'll take that for you. And clean them up, and then we'll do 50-50 breast meat, dark meat as our burger. So that's our recipe, at least over here at the turkey farm. But at the same time, I'll do the same thing with wild turkey. But like just brightening up either a burger, or even I could see this with sausage as well. I find that Granny Smith apple cubed up and incorporated into the burger, like you talk about a little surprise in there. Just this, the tart sweet inside of just a salt and peppered 50-50 burger patty made with turkey. Man, is that hit the spot. I just had them a couple nights ago, so that's why I'm thinking about them right now. Is just Granny Smith chopped up into that. Adding that sweetness from that apple just really adds to that burger. It makes it fresh, makes it something unique. Mm-hmm. And you were saying like sausage, you were already mentioning, you've got your three flavors right there, but you even incorporate the pork trimmings into that,
right?
Just for that little bit of added fat.
Yeah.
Is that what you're going for?
Yeah. Just to make it so that when you cook it, it doesn't just burn, you know, so the pork trim really is just there, you know, the meat, like I say, binds it, cause you know how dry a turkey breast can get. And so the meat part of the pork trim will bind it, and the fat just kind of, it renders out and makes it so that the turkey's a little more manageable to cook, you know, so it doesn't just like instantly burn on the outside and it's still raw on the inside. And so it just kind of helps it along.
Dry-aged steaks used to be a steakhouse-only indulgence. An old-world charcuterie was pricey due to being imported or created at a small batch-specific scale. Thanks to UmiDry, their synthetic dry-aging bags and casings allow you to create these meat-crafting treats in your own kitchen. Working in tandem with your fridge, the UmiDry bag material allows moisture and air to pass through, making it possible to dry-age large cuts of steaks or roasts. Paired with their curing and seasoning kits, along with safe and easy to follow instructions, salamis and dry sausage are well within your grasp. Use the link in the show notes and sign up for the newsletter to receive 10% off your order. UmiDry, helping us elevate our wild game from the home kitchen.
Continuing on the same idea, we got a chance to connect. Again, I guess I wasn't necessarily going through, you know, the woes of Instagram, but being a food guy, being a meat hunter, being somebody who's really focused on the bounty afterwards, there is a little bit of a feeling, at least a while ago, I felt this, where the hunting public, the channel, but as in hunting as a whole, saw us as like some sort of like side caveat that, yeah, we're in with everybody, but at the same time, like I didn't feel like totally in the middle. I wasn't one of the bros. I wasn't one of the hunting bros. I didn't need to go on an epic adventure because I got a life. I got a 9-to-5 job, but now I'm making my wild game work for me. I'm going to really take advantage of as much as I can get and really get every piece of it. And I think just as things have been coming around, trophy hunting came into its thing. And now maybe it's just me, but Chris, do you feel the resurgence of a meat hunting renaissance coming back? Do you see the whispers of people using more and enjoying more of their wild game, more than just on a, well, I got this huge buck, now I want to be able to make sticks, make summer sausage, and that be the end all be all? Are you seeing more and more people use and appreciate their wild game?
I really think that that is the case. I really am starting to see that. And I think that the trophy hunting and some of the sport hunting, you know, there's always been that, you know, the hunting industry, if you will. And I mean, how are you going to promote your brand? You know, I don't want to throw anything out there because I don't want anybody to like never send me anything, because I'll take free stuff all day. But, you know, just the, some of the brands out there, there's no way to quantify how good there is or to use it in a marketing sense. So, you know, they have their spokesman or their team this or team that, and, you know, they've got their Boone and Crockett, their Pope and Young, their SCI buck. And I think that for a lot of people that wanted to get into it, you know, they see these guys and, you know, they obviously pick the best looking and the most successful to push their product. So they're like, okay, I want to be successful. And that's, you know, what social media is telling me is successful is, you know, if I'm shooting a 160 whitetail every year, I have arrived. And I think with a lot of the things that I'm seeing, especially on social media, and it may be because of what we follow with our YouTube channel and our Instagram, there's a lot of homesteaders and, you know, rural people and that. I think that there's a lot of people that want to do more with it, like you say. They want to make stuff. And some of them may get a little intimidated by the, I mean, there's guys that you see on Instagram that turn out the most amazing Michelin five-star stuff. You know, the mom and the dad, they want to come home and be able to cook their deer and, you know, have it quick, have the kids like it. And you can only make so many deer steaks or so many boxes of hamburger helper or whatever, you know? And so I think you're really seeing that, you know, with people making a connection or a movement towards procuring their own meat, knowing where it comes from, because, you know, especially since COVID and everything, there's a lot more mistrust in big industry and even the government, you know? So I think people want to see where their meat comes from. They want to know, you know, that they put regular salt in it instead of MSG or, you know, whatever. And so I'm seeing a lot of that. I'm seeing a lot of people that are just cooking good, regular food, you know, with, you know, that's tasty, kids like, it's easy, you can whip it up in a half hour. And I mean, you've looked through my Instagram, nothing that we cook on there is complex, hardly at all. I mean, it's pretty simple stuff, but it's very flavorful stuff and it's very nutritious stuff. So I would definitely agree that there's a renaissance in meat hunting happening, because I mean, how much wall space do you have in your house? I mean, realistically.
Exactly right. There's only so much room for trophies. In fact, I was telling one of my buddies, he's got a lot of trophies. He's a very successful hunter and he's doing more with his meat as well. But I was poking fun at him and I was, you know, he was talking about like, oh, well, you're with as much meat as you eat, as much venison you go through, your freezer's probably pretty empty. I think you're getting close, wanting season to be here. And I was like, yeah, I am. I really want more of that. And you know, just as he was saying too, he's like, I think my mounts, I enjoy them. They mean something to me, but I think when I'm done with them, I don't think anybody's going to pick them up. Like, yeah. They will eventually fall apart. They will eventually degrade back into nothing. So even though like we want these things to be forever pieces, and I got my shoulder mount over here from this past year, but I do understand the lifespan that it has. It's very much about me. Nobody else is going to look at that and be as proud of it as I am. Mm-hmm. And so at the same time, to be able to share, you know, I can share that memory with my friends and they will be like, oh, that's really cool. That's a nice big deer. I think there's more to be shared when it comes to the plate at that point. I think there's a nourishing aspect, just like you were alluding to. How can I feed as many people as I can? Because again, you know, when it comes to making food, you know, it's a cliche line that says it's made with love. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, like when I get to share what we've acquired, that really is a bonding experience at that point. Anytime you're getting around a table, I think people, really enjoy that. And yes, as we're coming out of COVID, yeah, people are, they're skeptical on stuff. And I think even though like, ooh, things got real lean there for a while, I think I want to try something more with my deer. Like if I can go get a $20 tag as a Michigan resident and shoot a deer, like I want to get as much as I can for that, because now I'm utilizing, I don't want to say cheap meat, because I mean, I had to buy the arrows. You had to buy the bow. You got to buy the tag. You got to, you know, it goes on down the line. I think there's an old Jeff Foxworthy joke that talks about like he needed all of this stuff to recruit, to get the deer, and it comes out to the most expensive meat on the planet. It was like $149 a pound or something. He was like, my family's not thankful.
I actually nerded out on that,
but
one
just
year.
As we're going with that, like that's. Go ahead. Tell us, nerd out again.
I was
how expensive was your meat?
I did it one time, and this was years ago, and I factored in my time off from work and my rifle and, you know, the gas, and it was literally a deer that I shot on the hill behind the house, and it came out to like $17 a pound. But it was worth every penny.
Like, shoot, we're looking at glass case here of like prime meat. Yeah. You do it all over again. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. And even to go along with what you said too, like brands are getting there, you know, up and stuff. And I'm not excluding people who enjoy hunting as an adventure. That's what I'm not saying. What I'm saying is that I myself am getting asked more questions of how do I handle this? What do I do at this point? I'm going to go after a trophy elk. How do I field dress it? I'm going after, you know, whitetail a little bit deeper. How can I best pack that out? And so I'm getting questions. A lot of guys are looking for the now what. Like, I've already done what I'm supposed to do. Now how do I finish this adventure? And I think maybe that's what we're seeing too, is guys are not, they see the ending part. The end of the story is not you shooting the deer and it dying. The ending of it is you bringing it home, using it. That's where the story finally has its crescendo, finally has its climax, is being able to utilize that harvest. So that's my soapbox. That's what gets me all fired up when it comes to that. So having a guy like you like get real excited about that, that's what really got me like, oh, I need to talk to Chris, because this sounds like something we're both aligned with.
Yeah, I just, you know, I love getting out there and getting after it. But, you know, if you're not going to utilize the meat, then what's the point? You know, like you say, bring it full circle, you know, do something fun with it. And I mean, yeah, you get into 25 pounds of turkey sausage and you're casing it all, you know, it can get a little monotonous. But I mean, my wife and I joke about that. And, you know, there's 100,000 jokes that goes along with making sausage. I mean, if you don't want to know what's in the sausage, don't ask, you know. But, you know, we even do that with fish. I mean, you can only eat so many fried fish before you just got to say, damn, I got to try something different.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The tried and true has always got its spot, but at the same time, like, there needs to be a little bit of a change. Now, I'm one. I can eat chili for like 5-6 days straight. In fact, I think day 5 is really when chili comes to its max. Like 5 days of a little bit of age in the fridge, that is prime chili. But yeah, even my family will be like, we got to move on to something else. Like, you can keep eating out of the big pot, but we're moving on.
Yeah, and, you know, through the process, we've actually found a lot of new recipes that we've made our own. There's actually one. My wife doesn't like it as much as my youngest and I do, but we, you know, found a recipe for Hassenpfeffer. And I don't know if you guys have cottontails there, if you have snowshoes, but we don't have cottontails. We have snowshoe hares like you see on the show Alone. And they have like zero fat. And if you cook them regular, they kind of taste like a shoe and they're about the same texture. But if you make Hassenpfeffer out of them, which is a spiced, you know, Central European stew, there again, that was one of the not so good videos that I did, but it's actually had a lot of views because I think people are like, okay, my kid shot a rabbit. What do I do with it? And, you know, it just comes out fantastic because you use a lot of bacon in it to, you know, allow you to digest and taste the protein in the meat. And then, you know, the spices that you use with it are complementary. We actually use huckleberry jam. Huckleberries are big here because they grow from, you know, you can get it from the 4th of July to Labor Day. You can still get huckleberries. And,
oh my goodness,
you know, so you put a little of that in there and stew it up with some potatoes and carrots. And I mean, it comes out fork tender and you would have no idea it was a snowshoe hare. You'd think it, I mean, if you knew what rabbit tasted like, you would think it would be somebody's farm raised, completely fattened rabbit, but just a snowshoe.
Yeah. I think maybe up north we have some snowshoes, but we're cottontail country, mm-hmm. at least here in the lower peninsula. They taste like rabbit. People will tell you, maybe it's the squirrels are a little more mild than the rabbit, but rabbit definitely has its own little, what do I want to say, unique flavor upon it. Mm-hmm. My wife said she didn't like the rabbit that I made. Yeah, it's been a while since I've made a lot of rabbit, but I tried to make rabbit and dumplings. My biggest faux pas was I was not good at getting the shot all out. Mm-hmm. So the bad taste in her mouth, maybe a little bit from the rabbit, but mainly from the BB that she ended up chomping down on, that turned her right off.
Yeah.
from rabbit right then and there. Go along with this Hostenpfeffer. Let's break this down a little bit. So we're with a stew in this. You're making it with the snowshoe, and yes, you're explaining that it is so lean that it doesn't have any fat on this thing. If anything, the fat is probably relegated to the skin, mm-hmm. that's really on the wide side of it, but even that is thin. Processing, as far as we're going this down, you're quartering that rabbit out. What's the basics there of making the Hostenpfeffer? Take me through those steps.
So basically, once you get it quartered out, we usually leave the rib section, you know, the rib cage as a piece too. So you got hind. Well, I usually cut it into six pieces. So rib section, loins, front, and hind. And you have to start with a little bit of bacon. And, you know, you use the bacon, you kind of render it out, and then you put that aside and you dredge the rabbit, you know, in flour. And since it's Central European, we use a little paprika, a little salt and pepper, you know, some garlic powder. And then you fry the rabbit and then you start making the reduction. You use some red wine and get all the pan drippings up, and you add, if I remember right, it's thyme, grated garlic, and what's the other one we use? I forget. I'd have to look at the recipe, but you just add that in there and, you know, you kind of reduce it, bring the gravy up, and then you drop your carrots in and potatoes and kind of give them a little brown, put the rabbit back in and add the huckleberry jam, and then stir it together to incorporate it, get everybody coated. And, you know, you can throw it in the oven for an hour and it comes out. And I mean, like you said, it's the simplest thing. But just comes out absolutely fork tender, and it just, you know, the earthiness of the spices that you put in it with the sweetness of the jam and then the salt of the bacon. And like I said, the fat on the bacon will actually, it does seem to penetrate a little bit, or maybe it just sticks to the flour mixture. Maybe it's just my imagination, but it's not like you're biting into a chunk of leather, you know, it kind of, between the cooking and having that fat there for it to kind of uptake, it really mellows it out and tenderizes it. And it just, like I said, it's just one of those things. Last year, for some reason, my daughter, when she was staying here, every time she'd come home, she'd bring a rabbit home. And, you know, we made it four or five times last year. I'm like, I got to do a film on this sometime.
Yeah. No, that's good. You know, it's so hot right now. We're sitting at like 85 right now when I finally came down to do the recording. So like a stew, just I made a squash soup the other day because my squash that I was gifted started getting soft. So It was like, shoot, I got to make it now. And I ended up freezing it. So we have squash soup ready to go for, you know, a cold night when I finally don't have anything, no time, we can just at least thaw those out, heat it up, and be ready to go. But like stews and soup just do not sound appealing at the moment. But doing a rabbit Hasenpfeffer, I think that is right up my alley. I think that's going to have to be happening this year. But that low and slow idea, like again, you know, you can barbecue it or you can have any sort of method that you want to do with that. But I think like what you were doing is dropping it, you know, sear it off, drop it right into a liquid that's simmering and just give it time. Hour plus can do an amazing thing. Things that are super, super lean just to, or super tough. Like again, those rabbits, all they do is run. Get, you know, just put a soft edge on that piece of meat and that's just going to respond so well. Sous vide has been my gateway for squirrels. I still pan fry them. I still like to do poach in some beer and then dredge them and then deep fry them and then eat them like a little piece of chicken. Like I still do that now and then. But at the same time, getting them packed into a vacuum bag, throw in some thyme, throw in some olive oil, some garlic, salt and pepper, throw that into the water immersion. So now the sous vide takes over, you know, a full day like that. And I finally come home, pull that out and the meat just, I mean, falls apart. It's not hard to find the shot if I was using the shotgun at that point, because now they're just, you know, the BBs are falling right on out. I just got to sort them to make sure they don't end up in the clean pile there at that point. But then to just take that shredded meat, and that gives me so many different avenues to go with, whether it's going to be, you know, throw it into a salad, throw it into a soup, whatever I'm trying to make with that. I did make bushy tail buns. I got to do that one again before I really finally solidify on that one. But that one's just to wrap it with some cheese and some onion inside of a yeast roll and then basically either deep fry it or throw it into the oven and let that sucker brown off the top. First time I did it, there was too much roll and not enough filling on those. So it was like, I don't feel like I'm getting anything on this one. So the second round's going to have to be a little bit more heavy handed with the squirrel on that. But I like where you're going with that as far as on those hard worked little critters, going low and slow on them is going to help multiply as much as you can get off those.
Yeah, about the only thing you can do this time of year, like you were saying, you know, it's 85 there. Our archery season just opened August 30th, you know, so there's guys stomping around the woods looking for elk in 90 degree heat. And that was why I wasn't hunting. But, you know, this time of year, it's nice to go out and get a couple of grouse and get a wedge of lime and some cilantro and make street tacos and, you know, cool you right off. Have a nice Mexican lager and some street tacos. Save the stew for later.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Make it, yeah. Mountain tacos. That's what I love out of those grouse. That's a great idea.
Well, supposedly, you know, grouse can produce your winter.
Great hour. I just love. Say that again.
Oh, I was going to say, supposedly grouse breasts predict the winter. You know, when you cook them and you pull the breastbone out, the keel bone, the darker the bone is, the darker your winter is going to be.
Oh, it's kind of like the acorn things when you have like here, if the acorns fall real heavy. Like you have a real like bumper crop. It's like, ooh, hard times are coming. That's why they were producing more of them. But I like that. If it's super dark meat, then hey, it's going to be a dark, dark winter. Ooh, boy. Well, this has been such a fun time, Chris. Thanks for coming on. For my listeners, where can they find out more about what you're doing over there in Idaho? Where can they follow along? What's your handle? And where can we find you?
Well, we have a YouTube channel and it's Half Ass Off Grid. And our Instagram also is Half Ass Off Grid. And yeah, it's just regular stuff for regular people. There's not a lot of sensationalizing. And like I said, that's probably why I don't get all the views, but hey, everything we have on there is real. So, there should be something for everybody. So if they just like and follow along. And if anybody has any suggestions on stuff they want to see, more than happy to, because sometimes I get in a rut, you know, you can only show so many grouse hunts or so many pictures of mushrooms or whatever.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, hold on, Chris. I'm going to let our listeners on out. Folks, I hope you enjoyed this hour as much as I have. Just getting to connect again with somebody who's real and who's got the ambitions to take on a passion that they're really passionate about. We have Chris. He's trying to get off grid. And so finding the work that has to happen to get that done. I think we can all relate to that. When we have something that we're striving for, things are getting hard and there's going to be those hurdles, but you just got to keep working past them. I mean, shoot, here I'm trying to go as much wild game as I can. And there's some days where, shoot, it's going to be dino nuggies right out of the freezer. You know, there's going to be those hiccups. There's going to be those times where you gotta go back to basics and then start over again. But the whole idea here is, you know, we can be half-assed sometimes, but we want to be going as hard-assed as we can when it comes to trying to make those ends meet, trying to get moving forward and achieving our goals. So, folks, if it's going to be you getting off-grid and you're finally going to be taking that step to really be self-sufficient, or if it's just you trying to cut up your deer and use more of it, make sure that the knife you are using is very sharp.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.